We know there are times where you're just too busy to sort through the mass of information that comes your way. So to make it easier for you to stay informed, subscribe to The Morning Agenda, WITF's news podcast, where the only agenda is you.
Funding for The Spark is provided by Capital Blue Cross, focused on creating a healthier future for our communities through innovations like its Capital Blue Cross Connect Health and Wellness Centers, which provide in-person services and inspire healthy living. Learn more at capitalbluecross.com. The Spark is also supported by UPMC. Choose UPMC for your family's health care needs close to home. Visit upmc.com/centralPA for a complete list of services and locations.
Dauphin County and Harrisburg have recently issued a public health and safety advisory following a number of overdose deaths. Pennsylvania officials have dubbed the opioid overdoses one of the most concerning public health crises our Commonwealth faces, and in comes M28, a nonprofit in Harrisburg that has claimed to found success with its faith-based approach to assisting those recovering from substance abuse use disorder. While the national average for staying sober for a year is just around 4-6%, the people aided by M28 Ministry in central Pennsylvania say they have a 60% one-year sobriety success rate. And today, we're talking with M28 Executive Director Jimmy Schambach and Board Member and Mrs. Pennsylvania America Susan Ewing Rathfun on exactly how they are doing this. Thank you all for joining us on The Spark today.
Hey, thanks for having us.
Thank you so much for having us.
Yeah, so first question here, can you tell us more about your program?
Yeah, so our program has existed now for about 11 years. We're coming up on that time for us. And it's been a long journey for us, working with people in drug and alcohol recovery and helping them find a better way in life. And so we've really come with a two kind of pronged solution of doing life coaching, mentoring with them, and then helping with practical needs assistance as they recover.
So how did you get into this work? Like, what was the straw that broke the camel's back, so to speak?
Yeah, it's a great question. So my dad founded the organization, and what really was the impetus for change in his life and to found the organization was he was pastoring at a church in the area, and they had this Sunday where they were talking about people who were involved in other people's lives in the community, what they were doing and how they were mentoring or walking with people. And they ended up asking the congregation, hey, how many of you people are working with people in the community? And at the time, only about 3 or 4 people raised their hands in a pretty large congregation. And it struck my dad to ask himself, like, what are we doing here? Like, are we having an impact on people? Are we meeting their needs? Are we working with them? Are we helping them move forward and grow and transform their lives? And so it kind of led him to step into this space, and here we are.
And how did you all expand to the opioid crisis? Because you also do stuff with housing as well.
Yeah, so This first started with us with just going to a local drug and alcohol recovery center and saying, hey, we'd like to work with people in your program. As they leave the program, we know they need support, community, people to walk with them as they leave. And then through that, we realized that, well, people need more than just mentors and life coaches with them. They need some practical needs things. So we've started a food pantry. We have what's called the House to Home Project, which is a good used furniture distribution center that we give, again, good used furniture and home goods to people. And coming this year, we're starting our affordable housing push called Esther's House.
Oh, wow. Wow. So let's focus on the opioid crisis and the circumstances surrounding it. In your opinion, what do you feel as though have led to this opioid crisis?
Yeah, so it's such an important question to kind of trace the roots of that. I think, and clearly, because pharmaceutical companies have been paying settlements for their involvement in this, I think it begins there. Pharmaceutical companies spent lots of money, resources, time, energy, trying to convince doctors and things that these were safe, useful, meaningful drugs for people to use that were not habit-forming. And that's clearly not the case. And the outflow of that has been What we have inherited now, Pennsylvania, as many people know, is one of the top 10 states for overdose-related deaths related to opioids. 80% of our counties have a higher overdose rate than the rest of the country. And so that's a big piece of the puzzle for us. I think you also have a lot of socioeconomic factors related to that, race-related issues. I think you have all sorts of education issues, lack of opportunity. All those things then can contribute to this. And for us, you know, we've had a lot of people, for example, come from former coal regions, for instance, where there's no more work or little work, and so they end up using drugs as a result. And so that's been a problem as well.
And Susan, let's bring you in on this. Can you tell us your involvement and why you got involved?
Yes, thank you. So I became involved with M28 5 years ago. I've been serving in a board role capacity for a little over 3 years. And the mission of M28 was personal and dear to my heart because I unfortunately lost both my father and my sister to substance use disorder and overdose. And then I've been raising my niece as my daughter for 13 years.
Wow.
And I was introduced to Jimmy, to the organization, fell in love with the mission, but especially their success rate, because they really are, I saw that they are truly changing lives and changing the lives of not just those that are battling substance use disorder, but their family members also. So that number of 300,000 Pennsylvanians battling substance use disorder does not include their families. And I always say, like, family members, you know, we too are battling along with them because we're impacted every day.
Yeah, indeed, and you being affected by this essentially puts you on the front lines of this discussion of this epidemic. Yeah. So how do you continue to do this work, especially when you know you have lost loved ones to this?
Yeah, so I chose for my pageant platform, it's titled Tragedy to Triumph, and I use it to go into schools, go into groups of recovery, go into churches, really anyone that is interested in hearing my message. And it's one of hope and encouragement, of empowerment. And I've been asked, isn't this difficult for you to speak of this personal experience? And it may have been at one time. However, I've found over the last year it's been really therapeutic for me and healing for me. And so it's ended up being a very positive experience for me and hopefully impacting the lives of those that I speak with.
Does doing this work help you in that grieving process? Because we know that we don't ever get over grief, but we become bigger in ourselves. So does this help you with that grieving process?
Gosh, what a really good point. Yes, to think about that, I think I was kind of choosing for years to not grieve. And I've noticed in the last year, maybe from what you're saying, just speaking openly about it, maybe being forced to speak about it is what it is. I think I was choosing just not to speak about it in the past. But doing so, yes, and finally realizing I'm grieving and it's like weighing on me more than it maybe had, even though it's been years. But it's a healthy thing. It's a good thing for me.
Yeah, absolutely. So to take it back to you, Jimmy, what does addiction look like? Because we know that it can be a wide range of things. So for the listener that's at home, that's like, you know what, that may be my mom, that may be my dad, that may be, you know, insert loved one here, but they don't know the sign specifically. So what does it look like?
Yeah, so we like to use this kind of ranking of things in the sense of you have use, misuse, abuse, dependency, and addiction. And so most people operate between use, misuse, right? You go out with friends for the night, you end up drinking too much, right? You get a hangover or something, and it ends up being this thing. You're like, man, I feel horrible. I can't keep doing that, right? And then you get to abuse where it maybe becomes a little bit more regimented. And then you get to this dependency and addiction, and where dependency is a sense in which you are using it to function in your day-to-day. You need it. It's something that calms you or something that makes you presentable and integrated into the conversation in your community. But the difference then between dependency and addiction is related to the use of drugs regardless of consequences. And so when people start then getting into that kind of last phase where they're losing friendships, people maybe have passed away, they've lost jobs, their home, this is when you can start to recognize it kind of more fully. And and that's obviously its most obvious parts. In the earlier stages, it's really kind of hard to notice. But that's a distinction we like to use to help kind of frame that kind of question.
You do have a board member here. So what role does community support play in your programming?
Yeah, I mean, community on two levels. So one side of the community is your community engaged in helping these individuals? Is there money available for them to help them rebuild their lives? Are there programs in place for employment and housing and all sorts of things? You need your actual physical community outside to help you with that. And then you also need people.
Yeah.
Your actual day-to-day, who you calling, who's checking in on you, who you spending time with. And that's been the big thing for us as an organization, and I think that's why our success has been so high, mm-hmm. is because we've emphasized on sticking with people for as long as they want us to be in their life. And so a lot of them, they're in a detox center for 7 days, they'll go to a rehabilitation center for about 30 days, and then sometimes they'll go to a halfway house for about another 90 days to mm-hmm. 6 months. And then they leave, then they're out. And it's just up to them. And so if you don't have community, you don't have people who are walking with you, your chances of success are slower and lower.
Mm.
And so you end up needing then people to help you when you need car repairs. And our organization helps with people giving short-term small loans to people who need car repairs and they need this or they need to purchase a vehicle. And we'll help along that process. And so just having a community you can lean back on
mm-hmm.
to help provide those resources, that expertise, that help, connections with people in the community, that's been a big picture for us. And the community is really what it's all about.
So my next question here, how does M28 Ministry measure and verify its claimed success rate of 60% for 1 year sobriety?
Yeah, so right, every year we work with anywhere between 60 to 100 individuals.
Mm-hmm.
And so those meetings and those individuals we meet with weekly. And so towards the end of the year, we end up going through kind of a vetting process to determine where people are at, how long they've stayed clean, what we've done well, what we could improve on, and ultimately then what their plans are to move forward.
Mm-hmm.
And so our process has been kind of an internal kind of audit into how many people we're working with, where they're at in the recovery, and then them disclosing essentially how long they've stayed clean as part of our program.
Yeah, and now for your program, your success rate is at 60%, where nationally it's at 4 to 6%. That's about 10 times as much. So what do you feel that you all do differently that isn't happening on the national level yet?
Yeah, so I think for us, we have an ability to stick with people for as long as they want us in their lives.
Okay.
So when I meet with someone for the first time, I'll tell them these two things. Like, one thing is our relationship is based on trust.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to trust me, and you have to be honest with me about yourself. And I need to trust you in the things that you're just saying and disclosing.
Mm.
And then the second thing is I'll tell them, I'll be in your life as long as you want me here.
Mm.
And our program is just modeled towards that.
Mm-hmm.
We resist any kind of transactional things, and we really just give of ourselves.
Mm.
And so we've had guys that have, men and women that have stayed in our program for multiple years, people that have been here for the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
And some people we've just met one time, and that was it. And so for us, I think that's been a big part of it, is we are committed to this slow, long-term life transformation process. It is a totalizing event. You can't just recover by dealing with one part of your life and personality. All of it has to be investigated. Every rock has to be turned over. And if you're familiar with kind of the 12-step language, that's part of that process. You are investigating your resentments, the things you need to make amends for. And it's a tough process, a journey you can't walk alone. And so we've committed to that long-term, slow, life-changing, life-transformation process, and that's been big for us.
Now, in our last segment, I brought up the quote, move at the speed of trust.
Mm.
So how do you all grow this trust with your clients, customers, what have you?
Yeah, it's a process of we do what we say we're going to do.
Mm.
We keep showing up when they ask us to show up. We I think some of it starts at this beginning process where they're kind of feeling you out. Can I trust you? Are you going to do what you say?
Mm-hmm.
And so we show up, we take them to jobs, we take them to interviews, we take them to trainings, we help them find places to live, we give food, we give other resources, furniture, things like that. And through that process, we earn that trust.
Mm.
And we do a lot to steward that. And for them, the process has been, as many people have been in recovery for a long time, learning to be honest again is a process. Mm. There's a lot of, you know, as you're using, there's this sense in which you are operating from a place of trying to veil yourself and cover yourself
yeah.
and not be, you know, outed for what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you've lived that way for a long time, it's a process to learn to be honest again.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, while we tell them, of course, we don't want you to lie to us, we do expect that that happens.
Mm-hmm.
But it's their way of determining, hey, can I trust you? Can I be honest with who I am? Will you keep showing up
yeah.
in my life when I tell you some of the things that I've done or things that I've been thinking about or things that have been going on? And I think that that's been a huge model for us.
Mm. And to the skeptics and to the critics, because I'm sure there's plenty.
Sure.
So what do you say about the critics that are like, whoa, you know, this doesn't seem actual. You know, they're fluffing up the numbers. You know, this is 10 times over the national average. I don't believe it. You know, what do you say to those critics and criticisms?
Yeah, luckily that has happened on occasion, but luckily it's not been too big of a deal for us. And we've found, I mean, not to turn the question, but we've really had a good sense of community of people in the recovery community who have taught us a ton, have walked beside us. And really a lot of our success is credit to the people who have come alongside us as an organization on this journey to really refine our approach in that. And so that's, I think, kind of typical of my response. I think the other thing I might say is just to come and see. Come and talk to the people that are part of our program, what impact we have made, what we have meant to their lives, what kind of stories they share, what kind of people they've become.
Yeah.
And I think that that is as good a testimony to our work as there is.
I will tell you this. Sounds like my grandmother. She would always say, "I can show you better than I can tell you."
Yeah.
how do you prioritize confidentiality and privacy while providing support and assistance with these individuals?
Yeah, so that's a big thing. We're really careful not to share anything that would violate anyone's HIPAA regulations or anything like that. And so, we're very committed to that. We keep the circle small. We don't share names with anyone. We don't share locations with people. We commit to that. I mean, people will willingly, if they want to, they can share their own story and they can occasionally we'll post some stories about them. But we're real cognizant of that. Obviously, it's in the name, Alcoholics Anonymous, Narcotics Anonymous. And so we do what we can to safeguard that and allow them to speak for themselves.
And for you, Susan, for you and the board, actually, over the last 11 years, because you guys have been doing this for 11 years, right?
Yeah, I think I said 11, but it is 13.
13.
Yeah, sorry.
How have you seen this organization grow since you jumped on board?
Oh, my. It's amazing. So I am in a fortunate role, a unique role as a board member. I'm privy to finances, seeing how funds, time is allocated and so on. And so being that close to the organization, I've been able to see firsthand the lives that have been changed.
Yeah.
And seeing the children of these individuals, significant others of these individuals and so on, and hearing their stories, hearing their testimonies, it's just getting better and bigger, and the reach and awareness of the organization and also the education of substance use disorder and recovery in general in this local area has increased.
So what role do partnerships with local organizations play in the success of your initiatives?
Yeah, I mean, that's an important part of what we do. Really being able to refer our clients to other nonprofits that are doing things better than we can is really a major part of the deal. So whether that's with helping with housing or it's helping with jobs, jobs and employment is such a critical place for us. And so finding good places, the staffing agencies, people like that, that can really help them, that's been big.
And how does M28 Ministry measure the long-term impact of its programming on the individuals that participate?
Yeah, so we've done some minor longitudinal studies, and we've done some things to connect with people who have stayed with us for many years just to talk about how things have changed, what they need from us now that they've been clean and sober for 6, 7, 8 years, because those needs change as people have reintegrated back into life. It's something that they now, are reaching a stage where things are different. They have kids now. They have their own homes. They have not the same needs they had at the beginning. So we're in a process right now, too, of kind of navigating that, seeing what they need and how we can continue to grow alongside of them.
Is it possible to achieve full recovery?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think recovery is a lifelong process. Now, you can get into some data, you know, and that's why we look at like the 1 year as a really big milestone, where once you reach 1 year, there's a lot of your chances of success for lifelong sobriety go up dramatically. And so I don't know that I would ever say that you fully recover, but it's a process in which you learn to be who you are, you transform your life, you grow, and you become a new person on this side of it.
So how can somebody seek M28 services? How can they reach out to you all?
Yeah, so our website's a great tool. M28.us is our website. And so on there's actually a couple forms where people can reach out if they need help, if they'd like to volunteer and be part of that. And that's where we look.
And donate.
Jimmy, Susan, I'd like to thank you both for coming on The Spark today and letting us know more about M28. You all are doing some fantastic work. Thank you for coming on to speak to us today.
Hey, thank you for having us.
Thank you so much.
Yes, yes.